My thanks to John. It has been really wonderful to spend most of yesterday, certainly evening, with him and to learn through him more about you that I could possibly ever learn from the written material, although the background information that I received about how you are exemplifying the ethic of service through your own personal commitments and involvement has been very, very gratifying to Dr. Wilkins and to our other DS guests and to my colleagues from the United Way and Corporation for National Service outlet here, the State Commission for National Service, to our volunteer center directors and many others that we've had an opportunity to get to know and work with over the years. And to all of you, let me tell you what a special delight it is to be with you today for many, many reasons. John read something about my background, and as you perhaps took note, it covered a range of career pursuits and reminded me of the time when I was being similarly introduced. A person who had that responsibility said, and he has been a teacher and a college administrator and a preacher and a businessman and entrepreneur, and I saw a little old lady nudge her companion on the front row and say, "He ain't none too stable, is he?" But I am fortunate to be one of those who can frankly and honestly say that my vocation and my avocation come together in a very powerful way, because I have had the opportunity for an immersion in the study of and the practice of the Christian faith. At an early age, I decided that I wanted to be a minister at the age of 9 years old, and was made what they refer to as a lay minister in the little country and one-room Baptist church near the community where I was raised. And I was not always sure why or what there would be awaiting for me in the years to come, but I was convinced that there was something that was honored and integral to the sacred creation of the human being, and that I wanted to find a way to speak to that higher calling that we all must embrace and celebrate. And my life has taken a number of turns over the years, but that simple faith and that simple conviction in the sacredness of the human life has remained. And I now find that in this particular pursuit, and I'll tell you a little bit about the work of the Points of Light Foundation and this great movement that we are a part of attempting to get more and more people off of their living room couches into the lives of people in need. This pursuit becomes a fulfillment of this lifelong calling, because I became convicted at also a relatively young age that by the admonition of how can we say that we love God whom we have not seen and despise our fellow man whom we see daily. And I want to really provide for you who might be considered the choir. You understand the importance of going into every man's world, as my mentor Oral Roberts used to refer to, in order to witness and in order to manifest a set of values that have the potential for changing the quality of life of those that you encounter. What I want to do, since you are already colleagues with me and with others who are working in this arena, is to perhaps give you the benefit of a bit of a national context, and to give you some additional frame of reference of what is happening in the nation that will have the effect, hopefully, of encouraging you in your own individual commitments to go into every man's world and to manifest the high calling that you feel and experience by the way in which you interact with people who may need not only some of your faith and some of your commitment, but the transmittal of some physical and tangent or tangible assets and commodities and skills. We are in many instances, the only hands and legs and mouths and physical attributes of God that people will ever encounter. And I simply want to encourage you and affirm for you those who have made your own personal commitment to find ways to represent that belief and that value system through the course of your lives. I would say additionally that there are competing influences at work in the world. On the one hand, we have experienced an upsurge in the number of people who have been willing to become involved as volunteers in our society. And the statistics report that more and more people are answering the call to be individually responsible for transmitting skills or commodities to people in need. On the other hand, we are warring against, as it were, a kind of cynicism and a kind of mistrust of one another that would seem to be competing influences. And perhaps I can shed some light on not only why these influences seem to be competing with one another, but what we can do in order to help shift the balance away from this sense of cynicism and mistrust to this more engaging sense of commitment and campaign that is attempting to marshal resources in behalf of those who are in need. There is deep within the American psyche the abiding belief in the inherent dignity of the human life, and that each of us, in fact all of us, by our actions, either overt or covert, do build up or tear away at the most fundamental of human needs, which is to find value and meaning through community. Early in 1995, an academic by the name of Robert Putnam wrote an essay entitled Bowling Alone, America's Declining Social Capital, and that monograph sent shockwaves through the academic and nonprofit community. It was quickly established itself as one of the most widely read and influential essays of that year. And in it, Dr. Putnam discussed one of these trends, this sense of a decline of civic participation in American life. And he looked at some of the possible trends which was contributing to that perceived decline. The overwhelming response to his essay suggests that he clearly touched a nerve in the national psyche. Americans today are keenly aware that this nation's historic ideal of ordered liberty has become tarnished, and it is increasingly fragile, and that many suspect that this weakening is closely related to sharpening declines of neighborly assistance and social participation. And there are many different examples or affirmations of this basic point. Let me cite but a few. John Gardner, who is regarded by many as the dean both of leadership theory and the nonprofit sector, who served as the Secretary of Health and Human Services in the Nixon administration and who still today provides a commanding presence in the sector, said some years ago that what is undermining our confidence and angering and frightening us and eating at our souls and making us sick at heart is the senseless violence and the obscenity of racial hatred and the destruction of human dignity under extremes of poverty. In short, the shredding of the social fabric, the collapse of community. Not long ago, the Washington Post ran a series of articles, and their conclusion was that Americans are losing trust in each other and in our institutions. They said that America is becoming a nation of suspicious strangers. And this mistrust of one another is driving us away from one another into an abyss of cynicism and apathy. And then in the summer of 1998, the National Commission on Civic Renewal issued a report that was funded by the Pew Charitable Trust called A Nation of Spectators. The CEO of the Pew Foundation was quoted not long ago in her analysis of that report by saying that community spirit and quality of civic life have declined in the United States since the 70s. And the commission suggests that American cynicism and distrust of the government and the crisis of confidence does not stem from faulty leadership, but from the indifference of citizens who spend too much time in front of the TV and not enough time working with their neighbors. And finally, on this point, in 1995, Newsweek magazine conducted a poll, and they concluded that 86% of all Americans agreed with the statement that there once was a time when people felt they had more in common and shared more values than Americans do today. Well, what conclusion can we draw from this one source of the psyche that is affecting our nation as a people, and one of the competing influences of our time to counterbalance the growing trend of volunteerism that I want to also speak about? Our analysis and our experience suggests that disconnection, or people living in isolation from one another, is a fundamental problem in American society, and it's a characteristic of virtually all of our other human and social problems. It is a corrosive force that destroys the vitality of our communities and erodes our confidence in our ability to build a shared future. And the solution, and to borrow the theme of this of these prepared remarks, the solution, the antidote to that which ails us, is drawing people together through service. Volunteering and service is, in my judgment, the currency which helps to sustain the social contract. I'll repeat that. Service is the currency that helps to sustain the social contract. It is the thing that anybody can do which has the effect of bridging the chasms which divide. The solution to disconnection rests in our ability to convince Americans that they have it within their power to connect with one another, and in doing so is to their own best interest. There are a couple of authors I came across not long ago who said in the book The Fire Next Time that when we think about all of the strategies that we might employ to help reverse the breakdown in our communities, whether it's the breakdown in family structure, which we all know to be so fundamental, or whether it is this sense of isolation that people feel that they live in, or the sense of disconnection, as we term it, they said that creating a sense of community and giving everyone a stake in it may be the very best solution of all. We believe then, and the programs of the Points of Light Foundation and many of the organizations that we work with, is that disconnection need not grow worse. Americans need not be separated by their differences. Communities need not be fragmented. And service is available to us all. Any of us, each of us, can find some way to be of service to another. And certainly I don't need to convince you in this audience of that powerful truth. What I can do is to assure you that what you bring to this communal building enterprise is a needed ingredient in the larger set of strategies that have the potential for reversing a decline in civic participation and this growing sense of cynicism that others have described. I would suggest to you that there is one fundamental question that Americans must answer at this time of rapid technological advancement and demographic change, and as we obviously hurl forward into this new millennium. People, politicians, and social thinkers and policy wonks of all description have been for the past 25 years debating the question of what is the role and scope of government in our lives. And we are now finding ourselves going through a period of introspection and analysis as a people where we instead are asking the question, what is the role and the scope of the individual in helping to introduce important strategies to reverse societal decline? I believe that when confronted with the reality of the effects of society, of poverty and loneliness and desperation and isolation, among all the questions that we as individuals will be challenged to answer, is whose responsibility is it to introduce light and life and joy into the lives of those who without us may continue to live in some sense of isolation or along the margins? We cannot dispute or ignore the peril, both to those who are affected and to those who would seek to escape the question, unless we answer, it is my responsibility. Returning back then to this idea of what do we find embedded in the American heritage, we know that there is this sense that we are, in fact, our brother's keeper, and that we share the responsibility for the welfare of our neighbor. And so there are these competing pressures. Another writer by the name of P.A. Sorokin, who wrote a book called The Crisis of Our Age in 1941, opined that the weakening of civil society is traceable to cultural and philosophical movements that have yet to be defeated. And his conclusion on this subject of this contradiction, he said there's a self-contradictory tension of this century. On the one hand, the cultural simultaneous glorification of and debasement of man. And how many examples can we find and cite in our common everyday experiences where, on the one hand, we seem to be elevating man to some superior level where we think he is an end unto himself, and at the same time, we seem to act as though there is no inherent value in this human life? And how dramatic we see are those instances, particularly in some neighborhoods of some communities of this nation, where a trivial debate or conflict can result in the death of another person. It is increasingly common to read about young people at increasingly younger ages who think nothing of taking the life of another over a debate over tennis shoes or French fries or a girl or boy, and that would be a dramatic example of how we have come to some point in our thinking that there is no inherent value to the life of another human being. And so there are these contradictions. And on the one hand, the great French writer who toured this country in the mid-1800s and who talked about those unique attributes of the human or the American experience, he identified as the genius of America the tendency to join volunteer associations and the greatest long-term worry, which was egotism, which encourages people to live separate from one another, a stranger to the fate of the rest. Well, then what specific things can be done to capture both the commitment of those of us who believe that we are our neighbor's keeper, and to create a sense of momentum in the country that would have the effect of reversing this tendency toward cynicism and apathy. The responses to this challenge have been many and varied. We have found an increase in the number of academic institutions who, like BYU, have created focal points for student and staff and faculty service in the community. There are now some 600 universities that are members of an organization called Campus Compact. And just in the last 10 years, there's been this surge of interest on the part of these academic institutions to find ways to address the subject of service learning, where the curriculum is in some way affected and shaped to provide an opportunity for the students not only to gain a theoretical construct or framework in a particular subject, but to go out into the community and to demonstrate the power of ideas through the personal interaction with others. There have been larger and greater numbers of corporations who have said that we must find ways to be actively and creatively engaged in the community, not only in our philanthropy, but also by the way in which we encourage our employees to become actively involved as volunteers. And the reason that they have made this decision is because they have come to the conclusion that you cannot have a healthy business in an unhealthy community. And there have been more and more campaign-type programs and themes and approaches which have sought to get people to make personal commitments to what they in fact can do to change the tide from cynicism to engagement. It's in that context that the Points of Light Foundation is doing the greatest amount of its work. Let me talk now a moment about that specific array of programs and a bit of history that may also have some particular interest to this audience. There have been a number of Utahans that have had a powerful influence on who we are and what we are becoming, beginning with the now deceased former governor of Michigan, George Romney. I had the great privilege of working for the last 3 years of his life with Governor Romney. He was something of a father figure for me and a great mentor. And Governor Romney was one who not only had achieved great material and success according to the definition of society because of his business pursuits and his elected office and his work in the nonprofit sector, but he was one who came to believe in the later years of his life that the greatest title that could be bestowed upon him in a worldly context was that of citizen. And he dedicated his life to trying to stimulate increased voluntary action through local organizations, particularly those that are known as volunteer centers. And volunteer centers are typically small, locally run and managed nonprofit organizations that are in the business of recruiting, training, and referring volunteers. And there are some 500 of them in the country. And the Points of Light Foundation is their national organization. And Governor Romney was the founder of an organization that was known as the National Volunteer Center. And it was really a trade association for these 500 volunteer centers, and he literally traveled about the country working with community leaders to get them to, in some cases, establish these local organizations or to support them. Governor Romney further believed that this was not a partisan issue. The idea Points of Light was first made popular by George Bush when he was campaigning for the presidency, and he used the term 1,000 points of light as a metaphor for the individual action and benefit of American citizens who could light the corner of darkness wherever they were and by their voluntary action. And so he became well known for this term, and the Points of Light Foundation came into being shortly after he used the term. And we set about to develop a set of strategies that would promote and support volunteering in this country. But many people said, well, because a Republican president used the term, there must be some partisan political agenda associated with its development. And we continue to say that there is no partisan agenda associated with the term, but many people found it difficult to believe until actually President Clinton was elected and we established a very close and strong working relationship with the new president. He developed a program called AmeriCorps, which the idea is to provide an opportunity of similar to a domestic peace corps, where young people primarily would have a chance to go out into community and public service and receive a subsidy that could be used to support their further educational pursuits. And it is a program that has grown and blossomed in this country. Some 100,000 young people over the course of the last 6 years have had an opportunity to go into some form of public service through the direct participation in the AmeriCorps program. But again, people assume that if you supported AmeriCorps because it was promoted by a Democratic president, that there must be some political agenda that was to be served. And Governor Romney said, this is not about partisan politics. That this is about, in my words, restoring the body politic, building a sense of conviction that we all had some contribution to offer in helping to bind up broken communities, to connect the disconnected. As a matter of fact, our notion of Connect America, which is one of the campaign-type themes that we promote, was developed because George Romney said we've got to find ways to connect the inner city with the suburbs and connect people of different religious faiths and different class and ethnic origins. And we took from that instruction the idea that we could use as a synonym for volunteering, connecting with other people. And so Governor Romney said, if we must find a way to get beyond this idea of some government, or rather partisan politics, or a political agenda to be pursued, and he said, if we could get all of the U.S. presidents together on the same stage at the same time in promotion of this idea of increased volunteering and community service, we'll do two things. We will elevate the importance of service as a strategy so people will not believe that volunteering is simply nice, but they will see it as something that is absolutely necessary. And second, we will depoliticize the arena so people will not have the convenient excuse of saying, because I am not a Republican, I can't support the programs of the Points of Light, or because I am not a Democrat, I cannot support the programs of AmeriCorps. And thus the idea for a summit convened by all of the U.S. presidents and their wives was born in the mind of George Romney. And I've said in audiences in this state before, but I think because you can have a profound and appreciation for it, the idea for the President's Summit, George Romney wrote on a legal pad sitting at a conference table in my office in Washington, and he talked about this idea with other members of our board of directors and with the incoming CEO of the Corporation for National Service, who was Harris Wofford, and we agreed that it's something that should be done, and he began to explain his own vision, and it was just within a matter of weeks of him helping us to understand the benefits that would derive from this program that he died. And I know that he must be pleased today in understanding what has happened since, because General Colin Powell was recruited to help lead this effort, and he has thrown himself wholeheartedly into this great campaign, not just of getting more and more people involved as volunteers, but to try to focus their energies toward a agenda item that almost all of us agree needs particular attention, then, and that is on the needs of our nation's young people. And so the theme of the President's Summit was, what can we do to help introduce at least five fundamental resources that young people need in order to lead healthy and productive lives? And this campaign to get more and more people engaged in the lives of young people has been an answer to the sense of cynicism that Bob Putnam wrote about 5 years ago. And what I can say today has accounted for a surge in renewed interest in civic engagement and the civil society and the individual commitments that people can make toward helping to improve the quality of life of others. Because someone said, between the great things that I cannot do and the small things that I will not do, the great danger is I'll do nothing at all. And what we've said to people is that there is something that you can do. Perhaps it is in mentoring a child who needs a positive role model, who needs to understand that there is hope and optimism at the end of their own, perhaps very negative world experience. Perhaps it is tutoring a young person who is falling behind in their classwork. And we know that the rates of dropout among African-American males and Hispanic males in this country is deplorable. There are some 60% of African-American and Hispanic males who will not finish high school. And in so doing, will have fewer and fewer options for their lives, and who consequently, in many instances, will become dredges on society as rather than contributing members of society. And we can wring our hands and we can come to some broad generalization about what that might mean, or we can say, I will do something. Bennett Cerf, who many of you may have seen in reruns on the old quiz show, What's My Line, and who was a celebrated author, said, I must do something will always solve more problems than simply saying something must be done. And so you might find that it is within your power to find a young person who simply needs an hour or two a week to help encourage them and to help provide them with some sense of support when they're trying to work through a coursework that might otherwise be very difficult. And in so doing, give them a sense of options for the future. I must do something will always solve more problems than simply saying something must be done. And since this President's Summit for America's Future held in Philadelphia in 1997, we have seen thousands upon thousands of Americans make the commitment to do something tangible and concrete in the lives of young people who require that support. And what we're finding as a consequence of this call to action is that we are, in fact, reversing the tide, reversing the trend of apathy and cynicism that might otherwise engulf us, because people are saying that there is the chance to help interdict this otherwise sense of hopelessness that would befall us. And there's a very simple reason, as I hasten to close, why this degree of involvement in the lives of young people is important, is because we all need the sense of security and comes from knowing that we matter, that our life counts, that we are not some mistake, that we are not left to our own devices to find meaning to life, but that someone cares. I came across a paper written by another couple of academics not long ago, and on this subject of mattering, the author said that the most elementary form of mattering is the feeling that one commands the interest of or notice of another person. Mattering, the author said, represents a compelling social obligation and a powerful source of social integration. That we are bonded to society not only by virtue of our dependence on others, but by their dependence on us. And so I would encourage you today to continue in your personal commitments to find a way to become deeply and intimately and passionately involved in the life of other people, because they matter, and because your sense of affirmation and support can be the missing ingredient for their own sense of importance. And though you might be tempted to try to draw to some conclusion about the great and massive strategies that we think we might need in order to create some sense of stability in our society, you might take comfort from the words of William James, who said, "I'm done with great things and big plans, great institutions and big success." He said, "I am for the tiny, invisible, loving human forces that work from individual to individual, creeping through the crannies of the world like so many rootlets, or like the capillary oozing of water, which, if given time, will rend the hardest monuments of pride. Find something specific and finite that you can do that will introduce options into the lives of people that without you may feel a sense of hopelessness and defeatism, and from that lose their own consciousness of the value of their very lives." And finally, it was the anonymous author who penned these words: "Past the seeker as he prayed came the beggar and the crippled and the beaten. And seeing them, the Holy One went down in deep prayer and cried, 'Great God, how is it that a loving Creator can see such things and yet do nothing about them?' And out of the long silence, God said, 'I did do something. I made you. I want to thank you for who you are, for the nature of and the profoundness of the commitments that are well known throughout this country and the world, and to say that you are a fundamental resource within a large army of people that are responding to the call to become intimately and passionately and decidedly involved in the lives of other people in ways that count. And I look forward to our ongoing association over the years. Thank you so much."